Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Money Seat, the show where I put myself on the hot seat. I'm answering five questions only, no more, no less, with guests. The catch is they send me the questions. They don't send me the questions beforehand, and rather they're asking it, I'm answering it right on the spot. So today's guest, I have Emily. Very excited to see what questions Emily has in store for me, as I've known her for a very long time. And she likes to put me on the hot seat in life. So this should be fun. So Emily, tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Thanks for the intro, Ross. I am 30 years old. I'm from near Chicago, and currently I live in Washington, D.C. as a government contractor.
And can you elaborate on that, or you'd have to kill me?
I work for DHS as a contractor.
Okay. And how long have you been doing that for?
Only a few months. Before that, I've been in D.C. for 3.5 years, okay. But I've only had this job for like 5 months.
Okay. Have you always been in a government contracting, or were you in another industry before that?
My previous job was doing in-house background checks for a different consulting firm, but that wasn't client-facing. And then before that, I did research and analysis for a startup criminal justice nonprofit.
So it sounds like you probably have some advanced degrees to get to that point. What schools or schools did you go to?
Yes, I have a Bachelor of Arts in History with a minor in Sociology from Skidmore College and a Master's of Science in Criminology from University of Pennsylvania.
Okay, so you've been on the East Coast for a good amount of time now.
Yes, I grew up in Chicago and then I moved east in 2009 and never really came back.
Okay, so you've been out there for a while and you enjoy it. Yes. One last question. Are you married, single, engaged, and do you have any kids?
I'm single with no kids.
Okay. Perfect. So that means you should have some extra money to spend and burn in life.
In theory.
Great. So, thanks very much for that. And, I guess let's get started. Fire away question number one for me.
What is the biggest financial mistake someone in my demographic could make?
And by that, do you mean like age?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Age, employment status.
So there's a few big mistakes people could make. Number one might be hard to rate it, but I'll give you maybe one, two, or three in no specific order. The first one is not taking advantage of the benefits that they have at their company, because company benefits are almost always free or very cheap. So the first one is they don't, like within that, they don't contribute to the 401k. You'd be surprised how few young people contribute to the 401k. And if their company has a match, they're just missing out on free money. You know, it's basically the company saying, hey, Emily, here's a $2,000 bonus. And you're like, no, I'm good. I don't want it. You guys keep that. And it'd be shocking how many people miss out on that. There's also some other smaller fringe benefits. Sometimes you can get optional life insurance or disability or long-term care insurance through your company that is either free or very, very cheap. And some people, even though they might be young like you, they might have a kid, they might be married, they might be in a situation where it's worth getting those benefits. So the number one things I would say for young people is that they don't fully take advantage of the benefits at work. And then along those lines, the number two one would be setting up a budget and saving strategy. Most of the time they don't know, am I saving too much? Am I saving too little? Is it just all going to the bank? And then a lot of times I see them with two big bank accounts just sitting in cash because they haven't allocated it properly. Because being in your 30s is a lot different than just starting out. You're past college, right? You're in adulthood. You're in a next phase of life where you have to start. You're making more money, possibly in a second, the next level. And, working means you need to save and have a plan to start, because they don't teach you that in school. So a lot of times they just don't, they don't know what to do. They don't know what's going on. So I would say that would be the biggest mistakes people in your demographic and age make.
Okay. And then what, when do you think someone in my demographic will be able to retire? The economy is kind of awful right now. So I'm curious as to what you think, if ever I get to retire.
Yeah. Someone asked a question. It was similar, but it was different. And I would say for a broad point of view, some of it depends. I hate when people answer that question with "it depends," but I would say it depends on a few things. Social Security was something that our parents heavily relied on, and their parents and those future generations. For us, it will be there. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Social Security will be there in 30 or 40 years when we get to that age. In what capacity and how much, I don't know. It could be reduced, it could be less. So I think the point is that we might be more reliant on our own wealth and ourselves to retire than the government at our age, which means we need to probably build up some more nest eggs. The biggest question I always have for people is, do you have lofty goals? So I'm gonna ask you right now, do you have specific goals, specific things that you're thinking about in terms of retirement that you want to do that might cause you to need more money?
I would definitely want to travel okay. a lot.
Very common.
Yeah, nothing concrete.
Okay. Some people live a lavish lifestyle, and that's fine, and they want to maintain that lavish lifestyle, which is also fine. But then that means it might be harder to save for retirement, or it might change. Other people might want to just retire really early. You might not have a lavish lifestyle, but you might be done right by the time you're 55. And that means, we got 25 years left. We got to get started. But at your age, and really anyone who's in the late 20s to early 30s, even if you're starting from scratch, it's able to put together a plan and retire. It's not easy. It requires discipline. It requires a plan. It requires maybe saving some money here or there, sacrificing a few things you want now to get it later. But even if you had nothing right now and you were making, you know, the average wage for an American, which I think is like $60,000, assuming you weren't living above your means, you'd be able to start now and get there. It usually takes about 20 years because, like you said, yeah, the market, it's at an all-time high now, but, you know, it's been a little shaky up and down. The economy's been crazy with COVID and everything. But over the long run, when you add that long and you look at that, it's actually very predictable. You know, if you looked at it for the last 5 years, you know, it's crazy. But you look at a long period of time for any of that stuff, it's actually very stable and predictable. And you could kind of guess where it'll go in 20 years if you could kind of stick to the plan. So I would say, Emily, for you and people like you, if you don't have a plan, come up with one and stick to it, and you should be just fine within reason, right? Once again, if you wanted to do very lavish things, that would be a different story. Or if you had, you know, 5 kids and you wanted to leave them all $1 million, that would also be a little bit difficult. But a lot of that stuff is starting from the scratch and getting it going. And if you figure out what you want to do and where you want to end up going, then it's a lot easier to get there. As well.
Great. And then regardless of employer match percentage, what percent of my wages do you think I should be putting toward my 401k?
Yeah. You know what? I'm glad you asked that, because that's been one of the most popular questions people have asked me so far. And that's why I bring it back to that question you ask, is what's a pitfall of most people, and it's not setting up a savings. So I always use this a percentage. A percentage is the best way, because it's hard to say a dollar amount based on how much people make and everything. But let's say we're not including anything you do at work. We're not including anything that the company matches. It's just you on your own. You should be saving at least 10% of your income, of your gross income before taxes, whether it's to the bank, whether it's to an IRA, whether it's to another type of investing. But you should have some 10, 15, 20%, depending on your aggressiveness, that is not being spent, right? It's accumulating cash or money somewhere. And if you can't afford that, for instance, if you're looking at your income and you're like, well, I don't have that left over, then you're either spending too much on something else, right? Your rent's too high, you're going out too much, you're driving a car, right? You're exceeding your means, or maybe you could find another job and earn some extra money to get to that point. But yeah, you got to be saving 10%. If you don't, you're just going to be in this constant cycle of feeling like you never have anything. And that's in the minimum. I would recommend do more if you can. If you're single and you don't have kids, your expenses should be lower. So maybe you could save more now, because in the future, you know, I get it. Life is only becomes harder and it might not be realistic. Can I ask you if you're currently, do you know what you're currently saving in terms of a percentage?
My 401k is at 5%, which is what my employer matches. And okay. Then in terms of saving, I'm not sure of the percent, but I look at the amount and I think, okay, that's fine.
Okay. So you're probably, that's already 10% that you're being saved just in the 401k. And I'm sure you're not spending all your money on stuff. So yeah, you're already probably in the 15, 20% or higher range, which is great. So then on that basic level, yeah, you've already accomplished something that most people in your demographic and age don't, which is to save that amount. So congrats on that.
Thank you.
Any follow-up on that?
It's kind of a follow-up and a different question than the same time, but should I be investing as someone who's only been in the real world for about 6 years?
Yes, you should always be investing. Of that 10%, it shouldn't all go into cash, because as you know, especially now, interest rates are at an all-time low. So if your money's in the bank, which you obviously do, we all need money in the bank, but at a certain point, it's earning, you know, 0.1%. You know, you have $1,000 in the bank and you earn $10 a year. But that's not doing anything for you, right? You should be taking, you know, 5-10% of that, half of that 10%, and investing into something, whether it's a, you know, investment account in the market, whether it's alternative investing. I mean, some people like to do like gold and silver. Some people like to do like art. Some people do real estate if you're passionate about that. I would find a few different avenues and find your passions and do it. There's a lot of great apps out there to help young people who are new and inexperienced, you know, Acorns and stuff like that, to actually get familiar. So they only need a few $100 to start, and then they're like, oh, okay, I get it now. And then they could take the next steps. I always tell people with investing, you should walk before you run, right? Because they make it seem easy, but it's not. You need to know a little bit. So hopefully that helps answer your question.
On my birthday, Schwab sent me an email saying, basically implying, you're 30 now. That means you're old. Get invested, grandma.
You know, that's funny, but it's very true. Because most people do start too late and most people don't know where to start, because it could be scary. So yeah, that's funny that they sent that out on your 30th birthday. Did you end up investing or no?
Yes. You did. I had an account before that.
Okay.
That's why they hit me up. But
so do you have investment experience?
Not really. Like, I have investment accounts, and you know, like a millennial, I just invested in companies that I was previously aware of and I thought were going in good places. But I mean, besides what I've seen on CNBC that my father watches, actually, that's another question. Like, what do you recommend I invest in specifically, regardless of my whims?
Yeah. So that's a good question. I can't answer that because, one, it's not something I could really give specific investment advice on this podcast. But I can say that in terms of investing, I always recommend people to feel more personally involved in their investing, and get some knowledge on it. So I have a lot of clients who are into the socially responsible investing. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's kind of a new thing. And I think it's great. And I think it's where our industry is going to go. And the reason why is people like to go eat and shop at places that are socially responsible and have a mission that they align with, right? You usually do business with companies you feel comfortable with, not just on their product. And why shouldn't you feel the same way about investing? You know, if you're a vegetarian, if you're against big oil, if you don't like the gun companies, whatever your cause is, if you don't want your money to be invested with those companies, you should have the option to avoid them, right? And so that's kind of what I encourage people to. Maybe if you have that, maybe if you do like art, maybe if you like some of those things, you can find a way to invest in things you're passionate about. My recommendation would always be to invest early and stay invested, right? So if you find a company and you don't know a company, just invest in an index, right? A general S&P index, a large index that just has a bunch of stocks, and just stay in there. Don't panic. Don't worry if it goes up or down. It's going to do that. And just kind of forget about it and see it over time. It'll grow. And that would be my investment advice on that end. Do you do any other types of investing besides stocks or bonds or just kind of the market right now?
Just the market.
Just the market. Okay. Do you have any passions? Would you want to do, you know, arts or real estate or the socially responsible stuff?
I would consider arts, and yeah, socially responsible, it does appeal to me personally, but I also know that it really appeals to some people.
Yes. Yeah.
So that might help it.
It does. And it's evolved a lot more. It used to just be like socially responsible investing was just, and for those listening, I was using air quotes when I said socially responsible investing, because it used to just be like, okay, we're not investing in these companies. And it didn't really do, it wasn't proactive. It was just, we're excluding these. But now it's actually proactive. It's actually going out and filtering and finding companies maybe that are being proactive for hiring women or paying women an equal wage. Or maybe it's something that's not in, you know, exploited diamond mines in Africa. Or just they're actually really finding these causes and they're doing a lot more proactive research. And because of that, they've actually done well. Like if you look at the performance, I actually tracked it last year for, I had a same portfolio of risk, of same aggressive portfolio of non-socially responsible versus socially. And the socially responsible beat it by like, I think like 1% or 1.5%. Now that was just 1 year and it's not a large sample size to say if it's better, but I just thought that was interesting because I do think that people are more conscious of where they shop and where they place their business, which means that's going to affect the bottom line of some businesses positively and negatively. Also, I always bring it up because you can't do it through your 401k. The downside is they don't offer these at 401k and they probably never will. So if you want to invest and that's your cause, you kind of have to do it on your own. So a lot of people aren't aware that it's even an option. And that's why I like to bring it up, because you have to do some proactive digging and take the initiative to do that on that end. So hopefully that answered that question with some tangents on my end.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, you've made me want to reread the giant pamphlets I get from my new job. Just list all the different 401k options.
Yeah.
It's very overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I would say it's good to skim it. You don't have to read it page by page, but I would definitely skim it just so you know a little bit of what's going on. Can't hurt you.
Okay. And I think this is my last question or maybe my fourth. If I were 5 years younger, so I guess not right out of college, but yet, let's say if I were right out of college, uh-huh, how would your advice differ from what you're telling me as a 30-year-old with established career?
Yeah. So that's a different conversation. And that's a very good point. You're right out of college. You have your first job. Let's say this is your first job ever. It would be similar to what I said, which would be make sure you take advantage of the benefits at work and they have a 401k. But it's not going to be necessarily, hey, let's set up a savings account and start investing right away. It might be a budgeting, more of a budgeting conversation. Let's set up a budget for you. How much are you spending? How much are you making? And do you have debts? A lot of this I work with right out of college is based on paying off those student loans. Not everyone has those. And if they don't, that might be a similar conversation with what I'd be talking with someone like you on. But the most important thing to work with young people on is to get rid of those debts. Because until they do, one, it's hard to get to the next level and save and grow your wealth. But two, psychologically, it's always weighs on people. And getting rid of debts and being debt-free, at least on that end, or having it handled and having a plan for it, is probably one of the most important things that young people could learn, because they don't learn what to do right. At school, they just say, okay, you're going to have the student loan, and here it is. But no one teaches them how to pay it off and compounding interest, and a lot of people don't understand right what it does. And they're just like, good luck, handle the loan on your own. They might have help from the parents, but they might not. And so getting that under control is the most important thing I work with on people, because I noticed that they get out, and I've worked with a few people who didn't do this right, and then they didn't have enough money to get a car they needed. They didn't have enough money to live in the house or rent a place they wanted. Or they were taking out credit card debt, and then that was compounding to their student loan debt. And so the whole idea of managing your debt is so important to me. I wish I could teach a class in college, because everyone in college and high school and really younger needs to learn how to do this, because you need to have the skill once you leave and be prepared, and almost nobody does. So a lot of my services aren't even on investing when you're right out of school. It's really about helping you budget and managing debt, which is why there's not a lot of resources out there for those people, because there's not necessarily money in that, but it's important. So hopefully that helps answer that question.
Yeah, I'm really lucky that both I don't have any debt.
Congrats.
I never did after college, and that I have a family who told me to never have debt.
Yeah, and it's that's fantastic. And there's some people who have that situation. And then as we know, there's millions of people who either have debt, they have some, they have a little. I mean, you know, it's crazy how much it varies, right? I mean, you could be a very smart person, but if you went to undergrad and were pre-med and then went to, you know, graduate school and become a doctor or a lawyer, a lot of that stuff could be unavoidable, right? You could have finished undergrad with no debt, and all of a sudden you have $100,000 of debt just because of law school or doctor. And that's crazy. And then you're 5 years older than you are, right? You're not 23, you're 27. So yeah, that's great to hear. And usually I say, if that's your situation and you do come out with no student loan debt and really no debts, then we should start investing. I would say, let's start. It doesn't have to be big. Let's set up $50 a month. Let's do $100 a month into an IRA and just give you some real world experience about how to do it. I always start small with people. You know, we don't have to do 20% savings. Let's start with 5 or 10, just so you can kind of gauge and feel it. Because people are always a little uneasy about this stuff when they're right out of school. You know, the market, things that they don't know sometimes scare them a little bit. So it's good to start small. But yeah, that's great. I'm good for your parents for saving and having that to help you out. And I'm sure you'll pass that along to your kids when the time comes.
Yes.
Yeah. Or buy a vacation house, you know, one of the two. Perfect.
Yeah. It really horrifies me that kids learn so much random stuff and useless stuff in school, yet financial literacy is really foreign.
I mean,
to most college kids.
It's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast, because I think getting that message out would be helpful to younger people. And also why I've changed my services and how I work with people to, like, not necessarily just be an investment advisor and retirement planner, but to be more of a financial consultant and like a life kind of coach, where I could work with some of those people, even if they don't have the big investable assets, because everyone needs some help. And until, like you said, the schools institute those curriculums, we're just going to keep churning out people that are very bright and very smart and have great futures, but might not be able to handle things financially. And as we know, that could blow up your whole life if it's not handled correctly, unfortunately. And yeah, I think it's terrible that there's a lot of people who come out and they don't have that knowledge, but they know the capital of, you know, Djibouti or some random country, right? I'm just thinking of, like, not that that's useless information, but there's a lot of information that I wish I had learned in school that would have prepared me for real life and real life in the 21st century, right? Not necessarily real life in, you know, 100 years ago, but real life now. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I like to consider those questions like 1A and 1B. So I'll give you that was 4. If you have one more question written down.
Okay. Sorry, I can't read my own handwriting.
I can relate to that.
So what do you think the financial world will be like a year from now?
A year from now, ooh. I honestly don't think it'll be too different a year from now. People like to think the future is going to have all these big changes. And first of all, the financial world moves very slowly. So the tech world might be very different. But the financial world, I think the markets will still be a little volatile. I think we'll still be trying to recover from COVID, and the rest of the world will still be trying to get everything back. I think more businesses will probably go under and declare bankruptcy than less, to be honest. I still think there'll be more of those small businesses, unfortunately, that'll go out. But in a year, I don't think there'll be too many changes. If you look at like 5 or 10 years out, I think there could be some decently big changes on the horizon. And one of them, I think, involves blockchain, where I think there are a lot of financial institutions will institute a blockchain to do a lot. And I'm not very familiar with all this technology, but I know that when you bank with someone or you do finance or move money or investments, things take a little bit. They could take days. They could take some more time. I think blockchain will allow instantaneous financial transactions and money to move and make it more secure as well. I think that's going to come with the big banks, you know, JP Morgan and Wells Fargo might adopt those. In terms of the investment world, I also, like I said, think we're going to move more towards socially responsible investing. And hopefully that'll be part of your 401k and more global scene in the next 5 or 10 years from that end. Otherwise, yeah, things, once again, 5 or 10 years seems like a lot of time, but in the finance world, things take a while to change. So I don't think there will be crazy flying cars and robots running things in 5 or 10 years. Do you have thoughts? Is there something you're hoping or thinking is going to happen?
I mean, the market's been so crazy. Like, it's wild that, you know, the average American is really hurting right now, but yeah, all the very, very super wealthy 0.1% just keeps getting richer and the market is doing amazing. So I hope that evens out.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, once again, if you look at a 1 year, it's always up and down and crazy. But if you went 10 years out, it'll look pretty, it's not as crazy as you think over that time. The bigger questions, like you said, is that people are hurting, and it feels like, you know, the accessibility for people like us to be able to put a down payment and buy a house is just non-existent like it used to be for our parents, who could work hard, have a regular paying job in middle America and buy a house, you know, where you want. You know, you're in DC, I'm in Seattle. Things are insane in terms of buying it. Like, if I wanted to buy a regular house in the neighborhood, you're looking at almost $1 million. You know, that's not something people our age have. So I'm wondering how the housing in that market's going to react to basically pricing out us and what we're going to do, if we're going to see more people rent and less homeownership, if there's going to be a bubble. I don't know, but I don't know about you, but the thought of having to put down, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 to own a home is not something I want to do. Used to be able to put that up and buy it, right? That's what our parents did 50 years ago. So I don't know, but that worries me a little bit, what's going to happen on that end, if that's, there's going to be any consequences between more renters than owners. I don't know. It might not be a thing at all, but it definitely feels like we as a generation in our age group kind of fall in this weird, like, where are we? Like, we're not upper class. We're not lower class. Are we middle class? Is that where we are? Like, I don't know. And it's just, you know, we're going to start inheriting our parents' wealth, right? All that wealth from our parents in the next 10 or 20 years will slowly trickle on to us. So then what are we going to do with that? Probably not handle it very well. So yeah, I think there's a lot of crazy uncertainty in financial, and what'll happen will be hopefully good, but definitely see some changes over time, hopefully for the good.
Yeah, my so I'm just across the river from DC, like I'm 2.5 miles from the capital, okay. All that stuff. My town, it's more like a city, honestly. It's continuously ranks as like the healthiest place in America, the most like commuter friendly, blah, blah, blah. And one of the statistics is I think Arlington is super high on the list of like millennials who make over $100,000 a year, but okay. At least in my neighborhood, it's still a very renty neighborhood.
Right.
Like people rent, and the people in the houses, because the houses are really expensive, are yeah. More like family type, or like they're like 40 something and above, because people my mm-hmm. age, and I make decent money, cannot afford a house around here.
No, and that's crazy, right? I mean, a lot of people our age who are making six figures still are not going to be able to have enough money saved to buy those types of houses. So the thing is, are they going to move away? I heard there was a huge exodus away from like San Francisco and New York last year because of the expense. So are we going to start seeing less populated areas with more affordable housing see an influx of like young people because they want to buy houses? That might be a case. People, like everyone used to live in the city, and then they would, you know, get a family and make some money and then move out to the suburbs. And I wonder if that's, now the suburbs have become unaffordable for a lot of those people. So now is it going to be the opposite, or is it going to be like what's like the rural parts of America? I don't know. But you're absolutely right. That's not going to change. People who make very good livings and very good salaries can't save enough. You know, $100,000 doesn't go as far as you'd think, especially if you're in DC, New York, you know, San Francisco, large cities with high cost of living. And if you have a kid, if you have rent, I mean, it's not as much as you'd think. And I wonder what the consequences of that will be, because it's one of those butterfly effects. I'm like wondering if that little effect's going to have a big ripple everywhere else. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's very true. A lot of people, you know, I had friends who had a baby, and they bought a place, but they bought the cheapest place in the suburb, and then they put their whole sweat and tears into rehabbing it because they weren't going to be able to afford one of the move-in ready places in the suburbs, because it's $1 million. So you find a place, you do some work, you do some stuff, but it's a lot. I wouldn't do that. I don't have the time and the energy and the expertise to completely rehab a, you know, a fixer-upper.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So most people aren't going to do that. Yeah. I think there's going to be, once COVID ends, there might be an influx of people who move back into cities and just rent like condos or smaller places, as opposed to people who leave them at our age and buy places in the suburbs. It'll be interesting. COVID's kind of thrown everything in flux, so it's kind of hard to see what'll happen, you know, in the next year. I'm hoping things can go back a little bit to normal and they'll settle down, and then we'll really see what'll happen. But it's a very interesting time we live in, to be our age and to be where we're at in not just America, but in the world. It's a crazy time. Awesome.
Yeah.
Was that it? That was the 5 questions?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Real quick. Are we off the air?
No, we're good. We're good right before I sign off. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there was something I wanted to say off air. Sorry, I interrupted.
Well, now the whole audience who's still listening is probably much more interested in the off-air comment. So I'll turn this off and sign out. Thanks again very much for joining me on the money seat, Emily. I appreciated you. I appreciate you taking the time out of your day and asking some very thought-provoking questions. Hopefully the audience learned something, and hopefully you learned something a little bit from being on here.
Thanks, Ross.
All right. That's all. See everyone on another episode of The Money Seat. Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professionals prior to making a decision. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful.